Welcome to Changelog and Friends, a weekly talk show about booking a 50 rack. Thank you to our partners at Fly.io, the public cloud built for developers who ship. Learn more at Fly.io. Okay, let's talk.
Okay, friends, I'm here with a friend of mine, Harjot Gill, CEO of CodeRabbit, AI code reviews, so awesome. So the explosion of AI for developers is very real, as you know. Some call it hype, some call it the future, Harjot. Either way, code review remains the bottleneck for teams. What do you think? How does CodeRabbit fit into this new world?
My message to developers is like, AI is here to stay. We have seen like great success with code generation tools, especially the agentic architecture. They're getting really good in terms of exploring your code and solving small issues. And it's only going to get better from here. This is like a time when you embrace AI. Otherwise, like it's like about getting left behind. And AI is not going to replace the developers is what we have been seeing. I mean, it's like just elevating the role of and it's like going from a tank battle to an air battle. Like earlier, developers were struggling with syntax and all the mundane and the toil, unit test cases, like all the boring stuff. But now we're seeing all of that is increasingly being automated with AI, fight the air battle, as they say. And the same thing is happening on the code reviews. And now you're generating a lot more code, and what's hitting you next is code review bottleneck. That's where we come in as CodeRabbit, generative AI-based code review platform, which reasons about your changes and elevates your role as a reviewer. Like you're not going and finding issues which are surface level at the code. I mean, it goes beyond static analyzers to understand and those changes, but it does elevate your role as a reviewer to look at the high level picture, whether these code changes are aligned with where this product has to be, whether these code changes are aligned with the overall architecture direction of your company. That's where we come and help.
So how does CodeRabbit work?
CodeRabbit, like the great thing about this solution, it works where you work. Like it's not like you have to now adopt a completely new habit or remember to use AI in this case. So it works. It deeply integrates into your Git platforms inside your GitHub, GitLab, and other Git platforms. And in addition, like 2 weeks back, we also announced a VS Code extension, which we have made pretty much free for all individual users. So there's no reason not to try it out. Like if you're already using Cursor and some of these like AI code editors, it's a nice compliment. Like as you are done changing, you know, making your code changes, just trigger the CodeRabbit after each commit and you'll be surprised at the quality of findings it will find and the issues it will find on top of your AI generated code.
Very cool. Well, I'm a huge fan of CodeRabbit, as you know. We're using it here at Changelog and you can see it in action in our pull requests. You can get started today for free and it's also free for open source. Learn more at CodeRabbit.ai. Again, CodeRabbit.ai. Well, let's start this show where we should start it.
Where should we start?
Sure. Yeah. Where should we start it?
Which season are you in?
No, oh, God. What a great question.
Isn't it over? I thought it was over.
No. That's not. He's asking for in the analog of Silicon Valley that Oxide is living.
Right. Where do you
what
show
season
up?
Are we currently portraying?
Oh, Oxide and Friends.
Yeah.
What season are you guys? Okay. Better question. I thought you meant like, what are you currently watching? I thought you were saying, what are you watching? I'm like,
that,
no.
That is a great question. Always merits a rewatch. You cannot rewatch that too many times. I mean, it is so prophetic too. It's amazing. They just like, I feel in particular that the AI episodes are almost chilling. I mean, they seemed a little outlandish. Now they're just like, oh my God, the AI did it.
Season six is coming to fruition.
Season six is coming to fruition. 100%.
Yeah. I mean, if Anthropic just disappears, we know why.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I feel that we are, because I also view it obviously as a cautionary tale. Right. And I think that there's so many times when I was watching it with my now 18-year-old where I would kind of pause it and explain that, like, okay, this is a real concept. Like they're presenting this in a very humorous way. But, I still think that season two, episode one, Sandhill Shuffle, is one of the most important single episodes for an entrepreneur to watch. Yeah. Not just the nagging is obviously wildly entertaining. But he raised too much money, right? And he didn't realize that he could have raised, Richard asks, could you have raised less money? And he's like, oh, right, I could. And they do such a masterful job of the guy kind of replays the history of his own startup in his head of like, okay, like we would have, like, yeah, we would have raised less and then we would have been at this other milestone. And like, yeah, it would have been difficult, but we could have pulled it off. And like, and then he's just like, you know, it realizes that his company was lost because he raised too much money. And we're very mindful of that. That's a very real phenomenon. And, you know, we are, you know, we obviously just raised $100 million and we were very mindful about that and making sure that we, I mean, because the flip side, at least for Oxide, is that it is, we have always believed that if this company can cross the chasm, it is a generational company. It's a huge company waiting to be built. And the number one risk for the company actually is running out of money, is actually capital. I mean, VCs hate to hear this, right? They're like, oh, that's your number one risk. It's like, yeah, that's why we're here. I mean, it's like we've got
That's why we want money.
That's why we need money. It's like, oh, all right. Well, is there any other way we can be helpful? It's like, no, you can be helpful by like, you know, by actually like running a check. It's like, wow, God, okay, that's kind of boring. We'd love to introduce you to like, can we introduce you to potential customers? No. Like, right. No, that never works. No, you don't even.
We're good to go.
Yeah, we're good to go. We actually need. So that is, you know, I think that I would skirt the question by saying, you know, we're mindful of all seasons of Silicon Valley and all stages of a company that represents. And how do we be the company we want to be without reliving some of the seasons of Silicon Valley, without instituting Piper Pulse? Without, you know, which I still think is one of the, and actually, did you know that the system at Facebook was actually called Pulse? I did not realize this. Got some ex-Meta folks. Right? You're like, you realize that that is like actually
real.
That's real. And also the chairs ad, do you know, they're the tables. That's based on a chairs ad.
Tables.
No, they're tables, which is a spoof ad. And you're like, this is such good satire and so biting. And it's like, oh, that's because actually Facebook paved the way. They have a chairs ad that has to be seen to be believed. It's just amazing. So it's like, how do we be the company we want to be? And obviously venture backed. I mean, we're very grateful for venture capital. It's very important for this can only be a VC based company. I mean, I think it's like, it's easy to be very cynical about venture capital, but it does allow you to do something extraordinary. You get this you get this huge amount of cash to go build the thing before you have customers, before you have a business. And, you know, that's a magical thing. And then you've got to hit, you know, the clutch and the gas just right. So, we're very mindful of it all. And I hope we are not, I hope we're reliving the good bits and not the bad bits. I love to be, but mindful of it all for sure.
So why is $100 million for a Series B?
Yeah.
Big Series B. Not too much. Like, why is that the right
number? Why is that the right number? Yeah. And I think that, you know, when we were not necessarily raising, right? So when we had raised our Series A and, you know, when you are a venture-backed company, you always have to be willing to take the right meetings with venture capitalists because you always need that next round. And especially a Series B, I think, is the most difficult series to raise because you're kind of a teenager as a company. You are, you know, teenagers can be tough because they've got adult needs, but they don't have adult strengths. You know, they're not like, they're not actually like contributing yet. They're on the cusp of it. They're right. Close. But you are, you know, I got two kids in college, so I'm definitely, you know, I'm feeling this right now. And you're just like, okay, or why don't I give you my bank account and you just give me whatever is left over? Let's do it that way. But you know, you're kind of a teenager at a Series B and you need to have, so you're constantly like trying to find the right partner for that and the right. And we, you know, we had a bunch of firms that are just like not very good, you know, so you're not taking every meeting by a long shot. But we, this firm that really wanted to get to know us and, you know, the first meeting was fine, but, then they came by for a second meeting and that second meeting was really good and they'd done a lot of homework and this is USIT. And, you know, the third meeting was real, you know, and you kind of have, it's courtship that happens over a long period of time. And, you know, they got to know us really well and they felt like, you know, when you're thinking about your next kind of financing, we think you guys need to go big. And it was bigger than we were. It's like, wow, okay. But really the way they structured it was great from our perspective and kind of de-risked some of the risks that we saw of taking that much capital. And it was really important because again, like the way still to me, the greatest risk to Oxide is that we just don't make it. We run out of capital before we were able to build. It's really hard to build a business. It's especially hard to build a business where it's like we're selling big machines, you know, this is not a home labber, right? Even though the home labbers would love us to do something for them. It's like, I'm so sorry, but
they are not your customer.
No, they're not. And it's like, the sales cycles are long and, but the flip side of that has been like, if we get there, when we were talking to customers, God bless our early adopters and our early customers, love them all. They've been terrific. And a couple of them have gone on the record even better. So grateful for them. Or tweeting it out. That's also great. It's like we had a customer's like, are we going to be able to talk about the fact that they're a customer? That they're going to be like, oh my God, Toby at Shopify just tweeted it out. It's like, oh my God. Okay. Yeah, thank you. I guess that cat's out of the bag. I guess the CEO just tweeted it, which is great. We are so, so, so grateful for those early customers, but we've talked to so many who are just like, oh man, I love everything about this. I love everything about this. This is absolutely the right thing we should go do. We were talking like, God, I just need a Fortune 200 retailer to have adopted this. And we're like, you're a Fortune 200 retailer. Like, you're the one to adopt it. And they're like, no, I know I am. And I would love to, but I just need someone else to adopt it. You're like, okay, all right. It's like, but I love this. If you do that, like I'm all in. And you're like, okay. So
there's too much risk.
It is. And the risk is, and you get it, right? The risk is like, you guys go away. The risk is you're acquired. I do love people like, I'm really worried you're going to be acquired by Dell. And I'm like, now I don't want to neg myself.
Do they know about your past with Dell?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
right?
I don't think we're the part of the podcast where you're like, no, never again.
Yeah.
That's why I built this.
I think Dell would not want us. We're a bit of a kind of a skunk there from Dell's perspective. Right. I don't think Dell's interested in us. And Dell HP, we are so disruptive. It's like that has never been the strategy, but people are understandably worried about it because people can rattle off companies that have disappeared, the favorite startups that have disappeared into Dell or HPE. And I've been acquired, and I get it. And we obviously that's not what we aspire for ourselves, but you also, there's only so much arguing you can do with something because like they've got a really good point. Right. So the only way, it's just like earning, how do you earn someone's trust? It's like one day at a time, you can't like gas it on earning someone's trust. And that's what it really boils down to, people trusting. And not just trusting us, people trust us personally. It's more that like, I need the trust that you're going to exist. I need the trust that you're going to be there. I need the trust that this is going to make it. And, I think that this is a big part of, and we've already seen that where people are like, oh, wait a minute, $100 million. We've had people like, I think you guys are going to make it. Like, oh, thanks. We think we're going to make it too. But it's great to hear it out of someone else's mouth. Like, oh my God, like you guys are actually going to make that. Like I actually, okay. And this is great, And I think that the capitalization is not just the capital that we need to go expand manufacturing and to go, because the other really significant aspect of this is that we knew this was going to happen, but it's been fun to see it happen where a customer buys one rack or maybe two and they're like, hey, what would 10 look like? What would 50 look like? What would 100 look like? And, for a long time, that was just kind of like, just kind of pillow talk. We were kind of dismissing it. It's like, it's great. We obviously always took it seriously. But as time has gotten on, like those questions and conversations have been like, no, I'm like, I'm serious. Like I've got budget. I've actually used this thing. I know what this thing actually is and isn't. And like, I've got this new project coming up, but this would be perfect for it. And these are the kind of numbers I need. And you're like, those numbers get significant really quickly. And you do actually need a head of capital to be able to secure the financing that you need to be able. I mean, see, there is a flywheel that you need for which you need to, like, this is not, on the one hand, hardware is not as capital intensive as people think because it's not like we're building our own plant, right? We're not, Benchmark Electronics is our contract manufacturer and they've got their own ITAR facility. We're not building a manufacturing line. There's a lot of things we're not doing that people kind of associate with hardware. But on the other hand, it is also capital intensive because like, yeah, you got to go procure a bunch of DRAM and a bunch of CPUs and a bunch of boards. And like, you can't invoice someone on that until it's actually been like shipped. And so there is like there, especially as the numbers get large, the financing angle becomes really important. So yeah, that's
is there a point where you do go build that stuff, or is it just so far away that you're not even thinking about it?
That's a great question. I would kind of think never. I mean, you know, on all of that stuff, we always try to keep an open mind. And I think that, you know, we've got a really great partner in Benchmark because Benchmark allowed us to do some things that are, I mean, like, look, we're an idiosyncratic company, right? As you guys know. And we are idiosyncratic tip to tail. And, you know, one of the things that was really important to us is that we actually own all of our own manufacturing software. So we wrote all of the software that runs on the line. And this is really unusual. Most companies don't do this. Most companies don't really consider this aspect of it. And I mean, what's funny is like the companies that do consider it are the ones that are like, it's the kind of the SpaceX's and the Apples. And the, I mean, the companies that take manufacturing really seriously do consider it, but companies at our scale generally don't, in part because maybe they don't have the luxury of doing it. But it was very important to us to own all of the software involved in the manufacturing line. But because we do that, like we have, like we've got, it is a truly great partnership where they're doing the things that they're good at that I don't necessarily know that we want to be good at. And we are able to do the things that are very important to us, like software. Manufacturing companies are not great at software. This is, you know, I don't feel that this is a newsflash. And we are in our DNA, we are a software company. I mean, obviously, you do software and hardware together, but our, and we've got software engineers with a strong hardware sympathy, hardware engineers with a strong software sympathy, but we have got great software expertise at this company. And because we can, we control all that. I don't think so. I think that this is something we would really look to partner for continuously.
Gotcha.
It's a wild ride. $100 million.
It is.
I don't even know what you, what kind of class do you go to manage that kind of purse? Like, who says, Brian, here's $100 million, spend it wisely.
Right. Well, this is, I mean, I think this
US
is
the, IT does apparently.
Yeah. Well, I know this is, so this is something that people don't realize about, cause it's kind of easy to complain about aspects of VC, but the, and the process can be, you know, any entrepreneur will tell you it's an arduous process. It's like, I mean, it is like coupling. It's like dating. It's like, actually, although, you know, my son plays college baseball, and I will say that you playing NCAA varsity sports does look a lot like raising a round. If you've got an NCAA varsity athlete, they are definitely because it's like a lot of options, and you're kind of like, everyone is trying to like find the right pairing, you know, and you're trying to really find the right partnership. But, you know, with VC, like they're going to give you a bunch of cash and they actually don't have a whole lot of control over what happens. You know, I mean, it's like, yes, you've got kind of like the board, you've got, you know, some aspects of what you've got a board seat or what have you, but like you're really trusting the company to build itself in a way that is wise and proper. And that's part of the reason why they take a long time to do their diligence. It's part of the reason why you take meetings with a VC firm when you're not raising, because they want to get to know you and they want to get to know you. So they trust what you're going to go do with it. So they know that it's, and, you know, I think that, you know, I think if anything for us, I think, you know, we're very much children of the dot-com bust. So we are, if anything, like the comfort zone we have to get out of is getting a little more aggressive on things that we would do. And because my, you know, my overwhelming bias is towards a bit of caution, because I think that, you know, we, as one of the advisors of the company who I've known for a long time, one of the first people I pitched on Oxide, laughed hysterically when I pitched him on Oxide, like belly laugh, like really hard laugh in 2019. And then he kind of came back and saw, you know, came by 2022, 2023 about what we'd built. And he'd be like, wow, this is amazing. Yeah. It'd be a real shame to f this up now. And I I'm like, it would. And I just remember Steve and I both
a lot
like,
of yeah. pressure.
Yeah. And cause it's like we both, like, this is, I'm not a serial entrepreneur. This is not like, I'm not going to take, you know, five more trips to the well. Like, this is it. Yeah, and
this
like,
is your, this is your one here.
This is it. And we got to make this one work. And so it's a lot of, you know, that pressure is a privilege, of course, But so I know, and in some ways, Adam, like the almost the comfort zone we need to get out of is being willing to knowing when to push harder in. And fortunately, I'm, you know, blessed with a terrific co-founder and Steve, and you know, and he and I both have the same disposition, and yet the same need and desire to go push ourselves as well. So
I'm kind of fascinated about the mechanics of this kind of thing. Do you actually take custody of $100 million, or do you have access to $100 million? Like, how do
they work? like it will like wires into your account. Like you raise around. Yep. You raise around
in your account.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, well actually, so I mean, kind of a funny story in this regard in our Series A. So, not only does it wires into your account, but is actually not yours until the round is closed, but it's like literally sitting in your account.
Okay.
It doesn't go to an escrow account. It's not like buying
it's
a
not
house.
Even escrowed. Like not you even have escrowed. It, but you don't own it.
But people will be like, it's in escrow. But like, you're like, it's okay. You keep saying it's an escrow, but it's like, just kind of like setting
escrows are real things that you can do. But
escrows are a real thing you can do it. But like, no one's going to do that. So this is where, and things get super, like when you're raising a round and you're raising a price round and, you know, people are going to invest at, and you know, people are investing conditional on other investors. So you need to wait until you kind of like hit the number that you got on the paper before like the round is closed. Like you're not close. So you can be like waiting on a wire and you're not closed, or you can. And you know, one of the things that we did in our Series A, when we're extremely grateful to our investors for accommodating an early close. So we were going to raise, you know, we ultimately ended up raising $44 million in our Series A, and our investors did an early close at 30, which was great because this was 2022. It was really brutal. The environment had turned very, very brutal. And we were, you know, so then, you know, like, okay, once I cross this, like this $30 million threshold, then like not surprisingly, one of the larger investors, institutional investor, is like, look, we wire last. Like, that's the way we operate. So we are going to operate. We are going to wire last. And I'm like, I'm kind of sympathetic to that. Like, they want to make sure that everyone else has already wired before they wire. Well, they go to wire and you're like, hey, you guys are $23 short. And we're like, oh my God, we're $23 short. And like, how do you end up $23? And of course, everybody is like, oh, I'll pony up $23. Like, are we short $23? Yeah, it's like a bunch of like grad students out for dinner or something. It always comes up short. You're like, okay, who did? There are only like four of us here. Who didn't throw in? And everyone kind of swears that they paid enough. And I'm like, of course, you know, it speaks highly to Oxide. Everyone's like, I'm in for $23. It's like, no, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. We can't just like put, you know, put a couple of bills on the table. The reason we're short is because of share math, and shares will get rounded down, and you end up, and you have probably, and presumably you have many rounds that ended up being short by a share or some very small number of multiples of shares. Yeah. So it is kind of like, and most people don't care. But in this case, like, that investor's like, no, I'm not wiring until you have like the $23. And we're like, okay, so we need to go back to another investor and basically get them to buy an additional share of Oxide so we can get to the threshold that we need. And to be fair, like that investor is kind of frustrated with their own treasury department on that on that kind of process. They're like, I'm really, and you know what, I get it. I think it's understandable to be pedantic, because when that wires, like, I mean, talk about like wiring information you want to have correct. It wires gone.
Yeah, you double, triple check that one.
We had we were talking to an institutional investor, or that corporate venture capitalist, CVC. It was late to a call. I hate it when venture capitalists are late. Hate it. Do not be late. Because I'm going to be here on time. Like, I'm going to be here on time as an entrepreneur. You need to be here on time. Like, you as a VC kind of have one job. It's called show up on time. Hate it when VCs are late. So VC is like 6 minutes late, but comes in very apologetic. I'm like, I'm so sorry I'm late. It's very out of character for me. We just had an 8-figure wire that went to the wrong account.
Oh my gosh.
And we're like, do you need more time? Like, we can reschedule. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
You need to deal with that right now.
Yeah, that's you go right deal there. With that. But it's like, I mean, this kind of stuff, like, when you get to the actual, like, mechanics of the money moving, you're like, oh wow, this is just like, and it's a super manual process. And it is like, you know, people making phone calls. And it's like, on the one hand, you're like, oh God, this is so manual. On the other hand, like, maybe this should be manual. Maybe this is not a bad idea for this to be pretty manual, because you don't do it very frequently and it is super, super, super high consequence. So when you're on that kind of, it is really tough. And the part of the reason, by the way, when, you know, this is the reason that, like, people, you know, opening up to a large number of investors, for example, it makes these issues become more complicated. You know, you've got to have, now you've got more people that need to wire, more people that need to get chased down for paperwork. So there is a big mechanical aspect to it, and it just doesn't feel like you're not done until you're done. But fortunately,
what you need is like a cap table salami attack, you know, like someone just sitting there, go ahead, shave those off onto my account.
Totally. Right. I know.
Round down onto my account. I'll take it. I'll take the $23 worth.
Exactly. Right. When it was,
cause it'd be a lot simpler if you could just have that on there. Like, yeah.
Well, there have been things that have been invented to make this simpler. So this is why, like, the SAFE is a great construct. So a SAFE is a simple agreement for future equity. It pains me to agree with Paul Graham, I think. Although Paul Graham, I'm like super complicated about Paul Graham right now, because he says things that I really strongly agree with and then things that I really strongly disagree with, like, often at the same moment. I kind of, my brain just kind of buzzes.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But one of the things that Y Combinator got really right is this idea of a SAFE. And a simple agreement for future equity, what that says is like, look, let's not deal with all this.
We have no idea how much you're worth.
We got no idea how much you're worth. And let's also, like, not wait until everyone's ready to wire and this kind of, like, waiting for the, like, tell you what, I'm just going to invest this amount of money. I'm going to invest $500K. And then at some point, you're going to have a priced round, or you're going to have an event that happens, an acquisition, or what have you. We will price it then. And when we price it, because I'm doing this in advance, I get a discount on that, or I get, you know, there are different ways that people kind of structure those things to incentivize them. But a SAFE or there's a cap. I mean, that's another thing that people do. We'll say, all right, one of the things. So you get this. So, like, I'm going to invest, but I'm really worried that I'm going to invest $500K and then you're not going to raise for like years. And then you're going to raise at this multi-billion dollar valuation. And I'm only going to own a little sliver of this. So to prevent that from happening, I'm going to put a cap in place. So if you raise at above this valuation cap, I get it as if it's at that valuation cap. And it's also a way for them to kind of be able to model it. So, but the SAFEs are great for that, because you can just, like, go right now. They can also be too great. They're kind of like candy, and entrepreneurs can raise too many SAFEs. They don't understand that how their SAFEs are stacking, and they go to raise a price round. It's like, whoops, you got washed out because you didn't keep track of the SAFEs. So this is actually something. This is where we need, like, these Silicon Valley outtakes for, because the HBO Silicon Valley, I don't think it really hit on the this is one of the rare things that
they
didn't
need
really
is a new season. I mean, there's so much new fodder.
They definitely need a new season. I mean, aren't we living the new season right now? Are we convinced that we didn't just, like, pass into fiction and we are just, like,
we're living the new season right now? We're there for sure.
I was thinking about some of the money that's thrown around right now, because I was reading this Ben Stansel piece all about, you know, and to individuals, you know, like hundreds of millions to steal a AI researcher from Apple to Meta or whatever.
And, you know, they turn them down. On that stuff, though, you got to know, like, what did you turn down exactly? I mean, this is where you're just like, can you show me the paper actually that you got? Because this is not $100 million cash up front. This is like, on those things, I'm like, I always kind of wonder what they actually look like. But there's no doubt there's a lot of money being thrown.
Still, the numbers that we talk about now, you know, you just said $500K, and that was like because you're trying to think of a small number to say, like an individual might do or something.
That's right.
That's pretty much free money at this point.
That's right.
It's just, it kind of boggles the mind how quickly, it can't all be inflation, that we've ramped up our numbers.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we've got, it's going to be interesting to watch what happens, because I think the other problem is that we've got these companies that aren't going public, and, you know, we might start to see some of that certainly the aspiration for Oxide is to be a public company. That is what we that's what we want to go do.
I assumed that when you said generational, I assumed, well, that's going all the way right there.
That's going all the way. Yeah. Yeah, we want to be a public company.
How close are you? So you're we're actually going to cross the chasm.
Wow, I'm in a board meeting. I can just raise our Series B, you know?
No. I don't mean like in raises or whatever. Yeah. I'm just thinking like in your mind somewhere, there has to be like, maybe not a roadmap, but like you're talking about crossing the chasm to a generational company and like what is still in your way?
I think, I do think we're going to, I think we're close. I mean, you always want to knock on wood and everything else.
Sure.
But I think we're going to do it.
Are there hard problems unsolved? Are there things where you're like, we have to figure this out first?
The problems we need to figure out are there are for sure plenty of interesting technical problems that remain, no question. But it's the questions are not around, can we build it at all? Which, by the way, was a huge question. I mean, we don't want to,
you know. That's why your friend laughed at you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the other line he had is like, you realize that if you pull this off, it's going to be illegal to buy Dell. And that's it. You know, that's it. And so but it's a big if. And so there's so much we need to go pull
off. Explain that. Why is it illegal?
Because like you would never architect what Dell offers. Like that's not the way you would build it. If you're trying to solve rack scale compute at scale. So they just say like, I don't want to buy just one rack. I want to buy 100 racks. I want to have elastic compute in my own data center. I would not be like, okay, let me start with a 1U or 2U server and AC power supplies in each one of these things. And like running, let me go invent UEFI. Like you just wouldn't do any of that stuff. You're like, what you would actually do is what the hyperscalers have done, which is like, how do I engineer this thing as a whole? And how do I think of it holistically? And nobody likes the pain that they're in Dell HP Supermicro. And it is just an enormous amount of pain. Because it's not fit for purpose. It's just not what it's designed to do. And people that are trying to build, because we did this at Joint, people that are trying to build elastic infrastructure on HP Supermicro Dell are trying to do their own oxide on the cheap effectively. And it doesn't work out well. You know, and this is where you discover that you discover drives that you've not qualified. As I discovered at Joint, I didn't even know Toshiba made hard drives until I had such a vexing IO latency problem. I'm like, you know, maybe, and I'd finally over a course of like weeks and weeks whittled it down to like coming from like the absolute lowest layer of the stack, the IO layer. And I'm like, you know, I wonder, do I have a different version of HGST firmware on this drive? And I like pulled the drive info. I'm like, Toshiba makes hard drives. I mean, it was literally like this moment of like, this is not even like a company I like. What is like having like a Chevrolet hard drive? You're like
a Wilson driver.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You're like, what? What? There's a raccoon in here. Like that doesn't even make it. And you just realize that like, oh, I'm just being thrusted this thing because of some sweetheart deal. As it turns out, all of the Toshiba hard drives were basically bought by Dell and then just thrusted into that. You don't control your bomb with Dell. And that stuff is so deeply frustrating. And that is a deep frustration that people are all feeling. This is not like theoretical. And I think one of the things it is definitely vindicating. I think it's like a little bit surprising to even our proponents where they're like, you know, I was talking to someone today and they said that like these firmware problems that you've solved are really significant and important to them. I'm like, you know, you don't have to sound surprised. Like obviously we know it's important because we solved that. But like these pain points are really deep and really important. And the people running at scale are the ones who've suffered from it. And a lot of why people have moved to the public cloud is because they were sick of dealing with all that. And it's like, I didn't have to deal with any of that. I never had to deal with a BIOS upgrade when I'm running on AWS. Thank God. And now I'm dealing with this bill that is just like out of sight and growing all the time. And it's like, oh man, it's like, can't I own this infrastructure and still have all this delightful stuff that I get from the public cloud? And that's the market that VCs didn't believe existed. Believe it or not, they just didn't think it was there.
What's up, friends? I'm here with Kyle Galbraith, co-founder and CEO of Depot. Depot is the only build platform looking to make your builds as fast as possible. But Kyle, this is an issue because GitHub Actions is the number one CI provider out there, but not everyone's a fan. Explain that.
I think when you're thinking about GitHub Actions, it's really quite jarring how you can have such a wildly popular CI provider, and yet it's lacking some of the basic functionality or tools that you need to actually be able to debug your builds or deployments. And so back in June, we essentially took a stab at that problem in particular with Depot's GitHub Action Runners. What we've observed over time is effectively GitHub Actions, when it comes to like actually debugging a build, is pretty much useless. The job logs in GitHub Actions UI is pretty much where your dreams go to die. Like, they're collapsed by default. They have no resource metrics. When jobs fail, you're essentially left playing detective, like clicking each little drop down on each step in your job to figure out like, okay, where did this actually go wrong? And so what we set out to do with our own GitHub Actions observability is essentially we built a real observability solution around GitHub Actions.
Okay, so how does it work?
All of the logs by default for a job that runs on a Depot GitHub Action Runner, they're uncollapsed. You can search them. You can detect if there's been out of memory errors. You can see all of the resource contention that was happening on the runner. So you can see your CPU metrics, your memory metrics, not just at the top level runner level, but all the way down to the individual processes running on the machine. And so for us, this is our take on the first step forward of actually building a real observability solution around GitHub Actions so that developers have real debugging tools to figure out what's going on in their builds.
Okay, friends, you can learn more at depot.dev. Get a free trial, test it out, instantly make your builds faster. So cool. Again, depot.dev.
Starting to believe, though. They're starting to believe.
They are starting to believe. And it is funny when, you know, you'll have like a VC that, you know, pass on us or whatever, and they will send us a report like, oh, I just read this report about like, you know, cloud repatriation. And like, they send it to me. I'm like, why are you sending it to me? Like, you should be sending this to your past self. Like, right. I know this. Like, this is not news to me. I mean, are you? I had another investor that passed on us that was like, this Rust thing seems like, do you guys use Rust at all? I'm like, this do you use Rust at all? Like, we use Rust a lot. I mean, and he's like, oh, wow. Okay. I didn't realize that. I'm like, yeah, the company's name is Oxide. He's just like, oh, it's like this kind of like, oh God.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Anyway.
Well, like you said, they're always late, you know, a little bit late.
Well, and I think that they are, to kind of be sympathetic about it, like they are, the concern that VCs always have is product market fit, is that you, like the failure mode that they, I mean, there are two failure modes they're worried about. Failure mode number one is, this is going to be an outsized return and I'm not going to be a part of it. That is actually fear. That's FOMO. That's the fear of missing out.
For sure.
And that is a very real fear. And they fear that more than a zero because it happens less frequently. Like it is.
Totally.
It is very frequent that VCs fund a company that is a zero. That happens all the time. What happens less frequently and really gets under their fingernails is when they pass on a company that they could have invested in that then has returns a fund for somebody else.
Right.
That's the stuff that really drives them crazy. So that, so they've got like, that's kind of fear number one. Fear number two, in terms of like, they're not in the business to have zeros, right? So they actually don't want to have zeros. The way you have a zero is that you have a company that builds something that no one wants to buy. Like that's the concern that they have. And that you built, and especially like if you've got someone, and I get it, like you get someone who's like, no, like people have built this all wrong and I'm going to build this much better thing. You're just like, okay, now Mike, I got, you know, antibodies are coming up and you can see why people pass on Oxide, but because they didn't see the market was there. There is no other startup doing what Oxide is doing, which makes them more nervous. You would think that you're just like, and this is what holds them in like quantum superposition between fear and greed. And we have had VCs who are literally like overwhelmed with fear and greed with Oxide. And they're just like, God, there's no one else. Oh God, there's no one else. It's like, you know what I mean? Like there's like, God, the moat is so deep. Like, oh my God, there's no one else because you guys are like wrong. It has been kind of amusing as people realize like, oh my God, there is a market there. It's like
there is a market there.
Yes, there's a market there. Yeah.
There is so much. I don't know if like I'm still just not sure who your, you know, product market fit is specifically. I think it's on-prem because it's kind of clear. Own the cloud, that makes sense. But there is so much on-prem out there required.
Yeah.
That they're just like, thank you, Jesus, that Oxide exists. And they care about the things you cared about, from the Toshiba drive you never knew was there, the mismatch of firmware, how a sound could change IO, and your care for that level of detail.
Yeah.
Not just the hardware level, but the software that controls all that. I think that's the beauty of it. I don't know how you phrase it, but I would probably phrase it as if you're the only people who could do it. And maybe now that you are doing it, you'll have someone enter that is also highly capable. And because you've done it, they would compete. And maybe because you've done a lot of stuff at open source, they can maybe leg up because of open source. Who knows? But,
you know, that was always our assumption. So my assumption was, so when we raised in 2019, my assumption was one of the myths, the first myth that we are going to dispel is that you cannot raise for this company. And I had many people tell me, you cannot raise. You will not raise for this company. No venture firm will ever fund it. And it turns out it's more complicated than that, because it's so contrarian that it's actually that FOMO, it does like kind of light VCs up, because like, oh, this is like a big potential. And the problem we had actually was much more that VCs.
This is the next Dell, y'all.
Totally. That's right.
Right.
That they would be attracted to it, but then also terrified by it. And they would be kind of locked in that kind of, again, that kind of superposition. And we actually tried to, actually, this is funny, Adam, you'll appreciate this. That, like, I did try, and I can tell you that, like, this is where, you know, season 2, episode 1 definitely has some truth to it. You do actually want to disqualify from VCs, to be like, no, this is, like, you should not be doing this. Like, this is not something you should invest in. Like, you're a bunch of software investors. And they're like, oh, no, now we want to invest much more. You're like, no, God damn it. Like, I'm not actually trying to neg you. I'm not trying to do what Eric did to you. I'm actually literally trying to talk. And actually, there was a VC firm in particular that was so adamant. And I was like, I'm like, these guys are just like not kind of technically lightweights. And they just did not appreciate the technical risk. And I'm like, you're never going to get over the line. And I'm like, you don't understand. We are going whaling. You should be fishing from the pier. Actually, you should be shopping in like the fish section in Safeway. Like that is as close to it. And they're like, no, we want to go whaling. We want to go whaling. I'm like, no, God damn it. Like you don't actually want to go whaling. Like we are going like multi-year mission to faraway ocean. So, but we assume like we're going to dispel this. We're going to show that you actually can raise. And there'll be a company that raises behind us. And so we were kind of geared for that from the beginning, that there'll be another company that raises behind us. And so we did one after we were completely done with our seed. We're like, that was actually harder than I thought it was going to be. It's like, actually, maybe. And in particular, one of the things we definitely did do with our Series A is like, well, I'm like, I'm definitely going to find the investors that want to invest in this because they believe in it outside of Oxide. And we're going to get those folks on the cap table. We're going to conflict them out of investing. So we will definitely have the best investors for this, which we did.
I see. So that's like a hedge against competition or what? A
total hedge against competition. It's a little sneaky hedge.
Yeah, it's an interesting play.
The other sneaky hedge that we did is like, I want to make sure that we structure a company such that anybody who's attracted to this, who like, I want to go do this, looks at Oxide and is like, I'll just go join Oxide. I just like, I could go to like deal with the whole VCs thing. Or actually, like, this company is going to give me the freedom and the agency and the autonomy to realize my own personal vision of how this, and you know, one of the things I'm really proud about is like, we have attracted those folks and we've got a bunch of people at different, you know, and at any kind of slice of the stack, I can introduce you to the technologist who's got a chip on their shoulder about that slice. It's like, no, this slice, whether it's the security of the system, whether it's the efficiency of the system, networking of the system, the system software, it's like, no, I have got an opinion about this. And I'm coming to Oxide to kind of exert that. And, you know, at this point, it's like, we're going to be 6 years old here in September. It's like, you're welcome to raise behind us, but man, there's a lot of work to go do.
Yeah.
And And we, you know, we're still continuing. I mean, we got a lot in front of us still technically, but technically this has been now de-risked. I mean, you're asking, Jordan, like, what are the obstacles? Like, what it stands mm-hmm. between us? We've got a product. It works, you know, and we've got, I no longer hold my breath on an install or an update, right? Of course, because I'm saying that there's going to be an install that go, the next install is going to go wildly wrong. And we're going to come back to this about, you know, the time that I, but we, and so we're able to kind of level up and level up and level up and get to those next customers, the bigger customers, more ambitious customers. So it's exciting. And the problems in front of us are of that kind of scale variety.
Scaling. Yeah. Back on the working for Oxide thing, you guys are famous for having the egalitarian salaries, right? Like everything's, I don't know if that's what you call it, but everybody gets paid the same amount.
Yeah, I call it, uniform compensation.
Uniform.
Because people are like, oh, you think everyone's equal? Like, I definitely don't think that.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at with just thinking about raising money and, like, you know, people getting a slice of the pie. I'm sure there's equity involved in these, these people. It's not all cash compensation. And so how does that play out with that?
Yeah. You do get people who are like, oh, you're not talking about the total compensation because you're not talking about equity. Well, first of all, everyone at Oxide has got equity. Very important. I mean, that's just like important principle for me that everybody has equity in the company. So that's just like bedrock principle. The equity also compensates for risk, and risk in the company goes down over time. And there was way more risk in for employee number one than there is for employee number 100. And it's like, those are not going to be. And, you know, it is kind of funny that people are like, oh, like, you know, everybody in the company should have, if you say they should have equal compensation, which I'm like, again, not the word we use, they should also have equal ownership. And you're like, how does that work? Can you just like walk me through how that works? Like, I don't know, like, you know, you can do this. It's like, you can have an employee owned cooperative. I think, you know, go down to your local organic grocery store, employee owned cooperative. And you know, it's like I'm reminded of that old Onion headline, local Applebee's hotbed of Machiavellian maneuvering. you know, I think that just like, there are a lot of challenges. It's like, we are not an employee, that's not our objective. And I also think, by the way, this idea that equity is part of your compensation is misplaced. And this is a problem. And this is something that these large companies with product market fit that are public use the fact that they can kind of print these Confederate dollars in terms of their equity. And they use that as part of your compensation. Because if you view equity as part of your compensation, it means that you are selling your equity all the time. Like, you're a net seller on your company. You know, you're not buy and hold on that. And I just don't think, I get where people kind of come from with it, but people don't understand startup equity is not liquid. Your Google equity and startup equity shouldn't use the same word because they're not the same thing at all. Like, they are
sell one, you can't sell the other.
You can sell one with infinite liquidity and the other one has got zero liquidity. I think people don't often understand what zero liquidity means. And, you know, one of the,
it's not real.
It's not,
it's real, but it's not real yet.
Yeah. And actually, you know, in many cases, like from a liquidity perspective,
it's not realized.
The worst thing that happens is success, right? Because, you know, company kind of like stumbles and exits, and there are plenty of companies that exit for greater than their preference stack. So they pay out to the common, you get your money back. And it was like, you know, you may be disappointed with that. It's not the venture return that venture capital is running, but an angel investor be like, oh, this is great. Like, I gave you 75K and I got back like, you know, 91K. Quite great, you know? And, but like, not if a company's successful. Like, I gave you 75K. Like, where's my 75K? It's like, oh, it's like, sorry, we're 6 years in, we're 10 years in, we're 12 years in. And, you know, that liquidity event doesn't necessarily happen for a long time. So it's like, these are not in the same ballpark. And it's like, for a startup, your startup equity, it's very important that everyone has it. Very important. Everyone has a share in that kind of generational future. It's also important that, like, that's not what actually pays for the kid's summer camp. What pays for the kid's summer camp is cash compensation. And so that cash compensation is very important to us.
So how do you do it then? Do you just offer opportunity for them to buy at?
We make sure, I mean, everyone, when they join the company gets equity as part of their package. And then, you know, we re-up people over time again to kind of, because it's important that employees have a share in that. And then, From a cash perspective, you know, we have, it's been a little bit tough. We've been in an inflationary environment, obviously. We did just give ourselves a raise. So, we're now making $235, which is funny because like, this is, you know, the fourth or fifth raise we've had. And, you know, when compensation is completely disconnected from, you know, performance review processes and all this other kind of bullshit, I know we've talked about it, but I don't know, like, you know, kind of got final approval. And so you'd be like, oh yeah. And the all hands, like, by the way, everyone got a raise. Like, everyone's like, oh, that's great. And someone's like, literally will have gotten up and go to the bathroom. Or we did actually have this happen a couple raises ago.
Really go.
Where people like, there's a discrepancy in my paycheck. Like, I got paid too much. So no, no, we actually gave we gave ourselves a raise. Like, when did that happen? Like, oh, it happened like two all hands ago. It's like, oh crap, I was out and I didn't catch the recording. It's like, well, that's the one. Sorry, you gotta pay close attention to when you get a raise around here. It's been funny because like that's not a point of principle necessarily, although the transparency is a point of principle. The that is something that we have just always done. And then when we were really struggling to hire bluntly double E's, struggling to get outside of our kind of immediate network. And, you know, one of our engineers is like, I think we should talk about the compensation. And we talked about it. And this is in March of 2021. And that is in many ways the most important single thing we did in the history of the company because it brought in so many new folks to the company. And not because they were drawn to it wasn't the fact that it was uniform per se. It was the fact that it represented a different way of conducting ourselves. It's what it represents that's important. That like, and the reason that our engineer was advocating we talk about it is like, when I talk about oxide values to friends and family, they think it's bullshit until I talk about the comp. And when I talk about the comp, it's like a record scratch. People are like,
you're serious? What? Oh, you're really serious?
Well, no one else does that. Is anybody else doing that?
No. Not to the best of my knowledge. Not at ours.
No one's followed you even.
Nope. And we've been told over and over again that like, won't scale. And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe. Whatever. I don't know. I was told that when we were 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. We're now at 70. We'll be, or 80, on our way to 90. And I would say that it is playing a more important role, not a less important role. Because the thing it's had so many like interesting side effects. One of the super interesting side effects is everybody is hiring a peer. And when you tell people that they're going to hire a subordinate, their standards for that person are going to be a lot lower. And they're maybe going to overlook a bunch of things that maybe they shouldn't overlook. You tell someone they're hiring a peer and they're like, okay, I want to make sure that this is like worthy of us.
Right.
And so it's like, yeah, it is not easy to get a job at Oxide. It is, we are very oversubscribed and we've got people that take hiring extremely seriously. And I think the other thing that's been very important is that it tells us in a very concrete way, the importance of every role at Oxide. And, you know, because when we first did this, it's amazing. Obviously we announced it March 2021. We don't have a product. And people are like, yeah, but are you going to pay support people that? And it was always like support people. Like this is like a cast in tech. They're less than. And you're like, and you kind of take it apart. You're like, really? We're going to like, do you feel that? I want you to think of the very best support people you've ever worked with. Are they worth it? Oh, yeah, of course they're worth it. Okay, well, what if we only hired the very best? Like, oh, yeah, I guess it would make it work then. You're like, all right, asshole, I guess that's what we're going to go do. We're going to go hire. And so it's like, God, it's like, and why do you always, like, why is it always support? Like, so I'm so sorry. Like, support is so hard and so important. You are
the front lines.
It's the front lines with a customer. Yeah. Like, what is more? And like, you have got it's highly technical. It is, by the way, like under fire. You've got like,
always, yeah.
We're calling you because something is wrong, by the way.
Overwhelmed.
And like,
multitasked.
The ability to have the empathy, the ability to go technically deep. And then to have someone for whom, like, no, that's my calling. That's what I want to do. Because there is an upside to it. It's like the gratification you get is a high. right? When you feel like, oh, like that is really, and what if you attract people that are drawn to that? At, and it's like, we have got the best support people you can find. And I love our, and our support folks have been like, it has been such a relief. And we had, you know, one of our folks who joined us relatively early was like, you know what? I've been told my entire career that I need to go into quote software engineering to advance my career. My heart was always in support. And I left support and I went into software engineering, but God, I would love to be back in support because that's where my heart is. And I can do it here. And you look at what they've been able to do here because like there is, when you do that, like no one has to feel like I am doing wrong by my career by supporting a customer. No one, but conversely, no one also needs to feel like, well, I need to defend the throne room and I better not let this support engineer contribute back to the source base because what would that mean? We'd have to like change their pay grade. So as a result, like we have our support engineers very much contributing to the thing we're building. And it's like, and then you expand that to not just to support, but you expand that to these other roles, the operations roles, that the QA roles, roles that like people sadly like look down upon. In fact, QA is really challenging. We've got an open QA role right now that we're not calling QA because QA has been so like just absolutely looked down upon that we can't even call it QA, even though it's so we call it product assurance. Maybe we should, if you're listening to this and you, PA, we do. If you're listening to this and that is your calling, like you should be looking to Oxide because we are that's what we're, and it's been a real, it's watching folks come in with that kind of versatility and be able to do the kind of extraordinary things. I mean, this is not surprising. And it's just also not unrelated to the compensation, bluntly. There's just a very strong sense of teamwork. And because we have disconnected compensation from, because the reality is everyone loves the idea of like connecting compensation to individual performance, because like, it feels like, of course you would. Like you want like, you know, but the problem is that just leads you down to a primrose path where whenever anyone does anything, they think to themselves, does this advance my focal package or not? Is this something that I use my promo package or not? And great folks will not think about that too much and they will do the right thing even when the company is not rewarding the right thing. And we ask people, when have they been most unhappy and why? And almost invariably, it's when they are doing the right thing and management is discouraging it. And to be in an environment where it's like, no, we're going to separate all of that and now allow people to do the right thing all of the time, so much more of the right thing just happens. Now, of course, you got to hire carefully, and that's what we do. Mm-hmm. But we hire people that have that disposition. But man, you build a whole company that way, and it's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. You know, as I tell people, it's like it's lightning in a bottle. Don't you dare take this for granted.
It's almost like all politics go away, really. Like a lot of the politics get removed that could be there.
They're just pointless. The politics are like, I had one guy.
It doesn't get you anywhere. You don't get anything different because you can't politics. The scenario, because you just can't. It's not a lever you can pull.
It's not a lever you can pull. And, you know, I had one guy coming from Google who's like, and I think. And I think this is one of the real unfortunate things about companies like Google, Amazon, others that take people who have an intrinsic excitement for the technology and they break them a little bit and get them to like, no, what you should actually care about is that marginal 10, 15, 20% of your compensation. And you should distort your life and make yourself unhappy you should just like be thinking about that for everything you go do. And as he said, like, I didn't realize how much of my brain was dedicated to thinking about compensation until I didn't have to think about it anymore. Mm. And I can just think about doing the right thing. And that's really, really, really empowering. And it's been extraordinary. So yeah, I wrote an update on it about how it's going, and talking about the support engineering example, literally the top Hacker News comment. I could not believe this. So I'm like in the blog entry, I am effectively saying, you know, how could anyone, why do we single out support people this way? And kind of like shaming people who do that. Top Hacker News comment. It's like, interesting blog entry, but I'm sorry, no support person is worth over 200K a year. And you're just like, you kidding me? Yeah. And fortunately, one of the respondents to that knew one of our support engineers and is like, actually, best support engineer I've ever worked with now works at Oxide. And hey, Will, you're worth every penny with a pan yet. So don't listen to these guys.
Well, not listening to the Hacker News commenters is an age-old tradition that I've been following for a long time. I'm believing everything you're saying, and I'm buying it. I'm super buying it.
I'm believing and buying.
I might be the guy that says, does it scale? And I'm recognizing that it's continued to for up to 70.
Yeah. Fair question.
Again, how many people work at Dell? Because, I mean, you're going to get, if you guys cross the chasm, like, you're going to be huge.
How many people have to work at Dell?
I don't know.
This is a different question. It's a different question because I had an investor who turned to me at one point and is like, you know, because they kind of forget that we've done this, our investors. Like, they don't, I mean, it's not something they really think about. They know that our team is very good. They know we don't have attrition problems. They know, and also if they looked at one point early on, we're doing this, one of our investors was like, you know, we did the math and like what you're paying people is like dead on the median like salary per employee that we have in our portfolio company. So it's like you guys are not like off the mark one way or the other. So it's fine. Like, sure, you're just like doing it differently, like fine, knock yourselves out. So the VCs like kind of don't care. But one of these investors turned to me, is like, oh, because we in particular, one of our investors was like, was talking to Steve and is like, you know, Steve, you've really done a terrific job. And like you deserve a raise. And Steve's like, that's great news. That means we're going to give the whole company a raise. And he's like, you people in this again.
You people.
But we did, right? We did give the whole company a raise. And it was great. But this investor turned to me and is like, okay, you realize like you won't be able to do this at 600 people. And I'm like, you know, I don't know that we'll ever be 600 people. I don't know that. I don't know that you like... You can't build a billion dollar company with lessons. I mean, like nobody has ever done even what we have done. Nobody has even been at this relatively small scale. So like, I'm just like not, the right answer is we don't know.
Yeah.
And cool. Will things change? Maybe. I don't know.
How many support people do you have like per rack or per customer or some sort of metric that you could take and then multiply to see, right, like, well, at some point, because I looked it up, Dell, I'm fully admitting that they're probably overly bloated, et cetera. They got 100,000 people working there. So 600 seems small at scale. Maybe it's not, but just like, that's not scaling up Oxide very much from here. That's a 10X basically.
Totally. You
got 70. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And so I think that like a fair question. I also think that like, how many support people would Dell have if they thoughtfully engineered their products, made sure that the number of people that Dell dedicates to telling customers that you're the only one's problem. I've dealt with Dell support.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I have too.
And it's like you don't need very many people at a company to support a problem. I mean, it's the old Maytag repairman, right? I'm among friends on this one, right? Are you guys with me on this?
I know Maytag, but I'm not sure.
Okay, so the Maytag repairman was an ad from the 80s, and the Maytag repairman had nothing to do. And he had nothing to do because Maytags worked. This is when washing machines used to work. So, you know, those of you who have a modern appliance know that this is not true. But it used to be.
They don't work anymore.
They don't work anymore. Because it's a terrible economic model. I think that that's what companies convince themselves of. We want to build something that works. And the way you build something that works is when it doesn't work, you jump on it and you understand it in totality and you fix it. So the next customer doesn't have that problem. If every problem is only seen once because you've got such an ACES support team, an ACES engineering team, that they jump on it and they root cause every single thing from the very first failure. And they don't need to see 1,000 failures, 10,000 failures. How many support people do they need? A lot less than Dell has. So that's the experiment we're doing.
Right. So how many do you have now?
Four, something like that.
Four?
Four or five, something like that. Yeah.
Dang, that is a small amount.
Yeah. And you know, we will continue to hire, but like we're going to continue to hire extraordinary folks, you know?
Sure.
And,
that's the part that I say, how far does that go? You know, you have to be incredibly vigilant in your hiring, which right now you are. And at a certain point, you might have the demand for hiring and you might actually be like, we compromised a few times and we're getting out to the mediocre people, you know?
Nope, not going to do it. That is when, and this is where you, and again, not to God, it's like not to praise Paul Graham a second time, but this is where
Founder mode.
100% founder mode.
100%.
And this is where founder mode is actually extremely helpful. Because if you look at those companies, why does that essay exist? Because Brian Chesky woke up and suddenly there were a bunch of people at his company he didn't recognize and he didn't hire. And the failure mode is always the same. The failure mode is that they lose control of their hiring because they don't have good processes to begin with. The processes suck because they don't take it seriously. Mm-hmm. They know it's like, oh, we want to have a great team, but no one actually understands what that hiring process looks like. They don't actually, admittedly, I've had some advantages of making some grievous mistakes in my past that forces have a very good hiring process. They lose control of hiring. They hire, I mean, I don't want to say middle management is the root of all evil, but it's, you know, maybe a little too reductive, but the problem is that middle management grades their career on the number of reports in that organization. It's like, if you hire software engineers based on the number of code lines of code that they write, if that's how they value themselves, like you're going to get a lot of bad code and you're going to get a lot of it. If you hire management that grades their career based on the number of reports in that organization, guess who needs more recs? That manager you just hired. Really? We can't do it with fewer people? No, we can't. I need more people. Okay. You're just trying to advance your own career. I get it. And this metastasizes and you wake up and you have too many people and they all do it. And so I turn to this investor. I'm like, you know what? I don't know if we're ever going to get 600 people. And you know what? We are also the only company in your portfolio that has not overhired. And he's like, that is true, actually. I'm like, you don't have to say actually. And you agree with me, by the way. You don't need to say actually. But and we have not overhired and we are not going to overhire. Yes, that's going to mean that it is painful and requires vigilance. But we've got the very writing intensive hiring process, we believe it can scale. And we are not going to delegate. Ultimately, like every hire is ultimately, that decision is ultimately made by Steve. And yes, it's informed by everyone else, but like he bears responsibility for, and that's not going to change. And that's just called founder mode.
That's what that's called, huh?
That's what it's called. I'm always reminded of the scene from Pulp Fiction. I want a wallet that says founder mode on it.
Oh, yeah, man. That's a good one. That's a much better reference than Silicon Valley. So
bite your tongue.
Imagine you're IPOing.
Like we need a new season of Silicon Valley directed by Quentin Tarantino. That's what we actually
need. Okay, I'm in.
Now you're on board. Would that be?
Oh my goodness.
Like Kill Bill. As a startup, you know what I mean? Like this,
I do know what you mean.
Uma Thurman entrepreneur. I just feel like,
where can I put my money to make it happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
I'll bankroll that thing. I don't have very much, but I can borrow some, right, Brian?
Exactly. Yeah, I got tons of money. Who needs money?
That actually makes me think about, you know, money management with $100 million in your bank account. Like it's real. Like that's real money. You could just buy government bills and get, you know, millions of dollars a year. Oh. Like, do you have money managers or how do you?
What is that? Am I on LinkedIn now? You're like reading my LinkedIn. I mean, the number of LinkedIn connections I have had has just gone nonlinear because, of course, you advertise that you've done this raise and many, many people are offering.
They would love to manage that money for you.
They would love to manage that money for me. Wow. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I just gave it to the first person that came along.
So how do you manage
100%. Like, there's an issue. Like, how do you manage it? Where do you bank? You know, we got a
Silicon Valley Bank. Is that the one?
We were at SVB. We were at SVB and I think, you know, Steve will still say the most stressful moment of the company for him was when SVB, we were concerned that weekend and we had payroll to make on Tuesday, had a 453 or whatever it was, $1,000 payroll check that we needed to go out. And, you know, this is where you really, really, really know who your investors are because the ones who are just like, I'll write a personal check. And You have investors like, I'll write a personal check. You're like, great, I'm going to need that. And you're like, don't you have anyone else who can write? Sorry, that was like a rhetorical flourish. And then you get that one, right, which is like, I'll write a personal check. I'll write it now. Don't cash it if you don't need it. And we did have investors who did that.
That's pretty cool.
Where you bank is a huge issue. And like, then that becomes a cash issue because you want a real banking relationship because you got all this, you know, you want to have PO based financing and AR based financing. And like you, that is, so some of that you offer up as kind of a carrot to who is going to really own this banking relationship. Like, okay, right, we're going to bank with you. You're going to get this large amount of money. But then in return, we are going to get some services from you, whether it's venture debt, whether it's the ARPO, PO-based financing, what have you. So there's gotcha. There's a whole like science to all that.
Yeah.
Even credit lines too. I mean, you don't need the cash. I mean, you need the credit lines, but you have to have some credit lines because you can't spend your cash. You got to spend it differently.
That's right.
It's all about how you spend your cash. Well, perceived cash, you know, the bill that you're creating for yourself. It gets... Right.
You have a CFO or you just manage that yourself or what, how do you do it?
Yeah. I mean, we've got someone that we hired someone that, you know, and to help on that and to, it's been doing a great job and did the same thing, did a process for someone in finance, right? Same thing, same compensation, process. Process, same materials process, same, did it all. And, got someone terrific there. It's got coming. Yeah, exactly. Coming from Lenovo, having had done a lot of this stuff and has been, you know, I think it definitely has. We've given Todd plenty to do at Oxide.
So speaking of big money, there's been lots of big money going into data centers proposed and otherwise. I think Apple just said another $100 billion in the States. I'm not sure what that's going to actually be, but they're going to build something somewhere. Kentucky, I think. I think their glass is going to come from Kentucky. Obviously, that's not a data center, but manufacturing stateside, you have projects. Is it Stargate? What's the OpenAI one? Star something. You have XAI saying Stargate. They're going to put out 50 million GPUs in the next 5 years. That could just be talk, but they're certainly going to be deploying lots of things. Does Oxide have opportunity in this new GPU-based, you know,
yes,
heavy model training and inference world that's like blowing up right now? Do you guys have a role in that at all?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think for sure. Something to know about that world is it's really easy to focus on GPUs, and they're important. There are a bunch of GPUs. We do not have an accelerator-based sled. We will at some point, for sure. Something we've definitely got our eye on. When we do that, it almost certainly will not be focused on those training workloads. We focus on inference, and then we can kind of talk about that. There's a lot to talk about in terms of inference. But I would say that one thing that people should be aware of is that there is a lot of general purpose compute involved in what people view as an AI workload. So, I mean, I'm sure as you've been mesmerized by watching these things show their steps and the number of times, like if you give ChatGPT or Claude an image to do some, like, I want to recognize some things on this image, it will write a Python program. You know, I mean, and you can watch it like write Python programs, run those Python programs, get the results of that. It will obviously search the web. It will do all sorts of things. Like, yeah, that ain't happening on GPUs. Right. That's happening on CPUs.
So just standard servers and APIs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Blowing
so
up.
So it's like, and also that then like need to be containerized, right? Need to be like, you especially if you're going to have something where like I'm running general purpose compute at the behest of a user of this thing, as the behest of the internet. And, you know, we had Simon Willison on the podcast, on our predictions podcast, which is great. And he was talking about Claude Compute. The first thing he had Claude Compute do is download a UEFI vulnerability rootkit. And it's like, okay, I'll go execute this thing. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, you know, so there's a lot of general purpose compute out there. And I think that I think with the rise of test time compute and, you know, you the way these kind of models are going, there is more general purpose compute, not mm-hmm. less. We kind of assume that like, oh, if we don't have a GPU, like there's not like a place for us that's interesting. And, you know, it's always nice when customers tell you you're wrong. And, you know, we had our first customer, God bless them, Idaho National Labs. Idaho National Labs had to kick our door down because we're like, you're a supercomputing facility. We're not making accelerated compute. We're not taking your call. And they're like, can we please explain to you why we're interested in oxide? And like, but and finally Steve's like, I'm just gonna take this call. These guys won't leave us alone. I'm like, it's a waste of time, but fine. And he gets on the call. They're like, okay, can we talk for a second? Because yes, we have a supercomputer. We also have a bunch of Dell VMware that does a bunch of stuff that we need that's not the supercomputer. And can we, don't you guys replace the Dell and VMware? And Steve's like, I'm so sorry. We didn't take your call. Yes, we were.
That's what we do.
That's exactly what we do. I'm so sorry. And so there is that analog is where we are. I am learning that I need to not judge companies by what my perception of what they need is, because I have been disabused of that notion more than once.
Well, when you're running like you were at the time, you need to be focused. And so every customer interaction that was not your core audience or even close to it was a waste of your time, because you were worried about not being able to even be generational.
That's right.
To be able to succeed. So you had to have that position. And now that you don't, then you don't probably. I'm curious how all this flavors into sales. Are you in sales mode? What mode are you in now?
We're down. Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. We've got
all on sales. Sales as much as possible.
Yeah. And we've got, and again, you know, these earliest customers are all, no one, you know, everyone has a rack or a small number of racks, but with the idea of like, if this thing works, I'm going to go big with this. Mm-hmm. So, and this has all been true for a couple of years now. So it's like, we're now kind of at that go big moment for a couple of these different customers, which is exciting. So, but we are in sales mode, but like we're really focused on customers that really need what we offer, which is, you know, not even like a customer that's only going to buy a rack or two. Like, yes, we'll get to you in a while when we truly have crossed the chasm, but it's the customers that are like, no, I want to talk to you about 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. Those are the ones our customers that we're blessed to have. So exciting.
How big is your sales team now?
You've got, something like four or five people. Or five. Yeah, exactly. Oh my small.
Gosh.
Yeah. Small.
Yeah. That's tiny.
And, you know, we've got this very writing intensive process, and is this the right hiring process for sales? Kind of a question I had. Steve felt adamant, like, no, this is absolutely the right hiring process for sales. And it's been really interesting because there's, again, it's the way people feel with support. Like, you can't possibly do this support. People are like, you can't possibly expect salespeople to write a sentence. That is like, they're animals and beasts. I mean, like, honestly, people are like, no, like,
you write a sales beast. What do you mean?
Like, writing a sentence. Like, no, this is an animal. Like, you know, rips apart customers. It's like, is it really an animal though? Really? I mean, what we have actually found is that for sure it's different and it's not, you know, but the people that are attracted to that are really attracted to that. So we've got sales folks that are terrific and are the ones that, you know, the ones that can model themselves on Steve, right? In terms of like part of Steve's disposition has always been about how do we not just find new customers, but make customers delight customers, find that next use case for, look out for customers, be that trusted advisor for customers. And we want a sales team that go-to-market team that represents that. And we're really blessed with that.
Mm-hmm. How do you have salespeople make a salary? Commission.
Yeah, there is an asterisk. So the on sales, and we do talk about this publicly, but on sales, there is a commission component. And it was funny because it was a change to roll out because sales is commission based, right? And yeah, so people are like, oh, well, I want that too. I like, oh, why should the engineers get that? Like, okay, well, their base salary is less. So yeah, you can like, you also can make less. Like, oh no, never mind. I don't want that. Like, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't want that. In other words, like you're taking a risk. You're going to make potentially less and potentially more. I can tell you everyone at Oxide wants our sales folks to make a ton of money because they know that like if they make a bunch of money, it's because we're selling racks.
So what happens if today one of your sales team just goes out and books like a 50 rack order? A, can you fulfill that? B, how long would it take? And C, how would you go about it? 50 racks. They want it right now. They got the money.
50 would be smaller than some of the numbers our customers are talking about.
Okay, well, give me a number that would scare you then.
I well, no, I mean, like, that number does scare me, but like, all okay. we've already had to do this exercise for larger numbers.
You have.
Yeah.
All right, so you cross that chasm. I mean, that's scale, right?
Let's ease up. Not across that chasm yet.
Okay, you're out over it. You're over your
out
skis.
Over it. Out over it, and it's exciting. And it requires, I mean, this is where it is like, it actually is hardware you're shipping, right? So it actually, this is where you need to go into the supply chain, right? You need to go find those log lean time parts. You need to go lean on or leverage partnerships that you've got. When you talk about like big numbers like that, there's also a challenge of like the numbers get big, right? So now you're like, okay, well, we've got a lot of approvals that we need to go through internally. And there's a bunch of, you know, understandably, like you're going to actually like, this is a big number. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, okay, well, when can we get it? It's like, well, you know, it's like we need to get the PO before we can, you know, but we how do we kind of kick stuff off without having a PO in hand? Because like you don't, and this is, you know, we're very mindful of history in everything we do, but the history of the Osborne Computer Company, right? Famously, Osborne went belly up when it actually had product market fit. Now there's a bunch, and there's a great book, great, is it maybe in air quotes, but a book called Hypergrowth out of print, where Adam Osborne gave his version of events, but operationally, they lost it on operations is kind of the TLDR is like they had a product that people wanted and they died because they screwed up the operations of it. And they ended up with too much inventory of the wrong stuff at the wrong time. And they just went insolvent. And so like that can definitely happen. So when you have a customer's talking like, hey, I want 50 racks and I'm serious. I want 50 racks. And this is not just like pillow talk. This is like, what does this look like? Give me a quote. I need to go like, I'm going to go through my approval process. Then you need to be like, okay, we got to go light up bus bars, racks, rectifiers, compute sleds. We need to go figure out exactly what this thing is going to look like. We need to figure out where the long lead time parts are. We need to go on the inventory that's cheap. You just procure that. That's easy. And then you've got some decisions to make on, you know, people buying at that scale need some SKU control. You know, maybe I want different DIMs or I want, you know, you got to afford them that. There's that. That's a back and forth. Oh, there's a whole galactic amount of detail. There's an entire galaxy of detail that is not the building of the thing, which already has enough detail, but it is the operations piece of this is extraordinarily complicated. And it's why. Yeah. You know, it's why our operations team is, you know, we've got our operations team is terrific. Talk about like, you know, being just as important as anyone else in the company. And boy, when you go do one of these exercises where it's like, it's serious and we're going, this is not a drill. And you really appreciate it. Like, wow, this is just extraordinary resourcefulness and agility and being able to, you know, probably unsurprisingly, we've got a couple of our operations folks have got operations experience from the service. I got some, you know, ex-Air Force folks that, you know, are used to just like, how do we go deal with like very large scale operational issues and having to make up a bunch of stuff on the fly in terms of like, okay, we can't like your facility in Toronto can't do this. But there's another facility that you've got in Malaysia. What does that look like? Oh, and then then you have like the Joker in the White House spinning the tariff wheel. Can we like, this is hard enough, by the way, without being like, there is like, okay, there's a tariff. There's not a tariff. Now there is a tariff. No, now we're going to have a tariff later. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. It's like, okay, this is actually hard enough when everything stands still. And it's all challenging. It's just a lot of detail. You know, you just have to get, and you've got to embrace that detail and you've got to go headlong into it. And then I think the other thing that's been important for us is then be transparent with folks about where we are and where we're not. Like if we, you know, if and when we hit a snag, we're going to be transparent about what it is. And we're not going to present this to you as like, hey, this is a problem. We don't know what to do. It's like, here's the problem. You know, we've hit an issue here. This is what we're doing to resolve it. Just we're letting you know. And, you know, that is the way we've operated as a company with that deal of transparency. But if you are a Dell HP Supermicro customer, you get these same delays, but it's just like, you don't have any transparency about what's going on. It's like, where's this thing I paid for? It's like, oh, you know, I don't know. No one will tell me. It's like, no. We want to be sure that we are giving people that kind of transparency, but it's difficult and it's detail oriented is the answer.
It's got to be hard to plan that far ahead. I mean, do you just spend a lot of cash like holding stuff? How do you reserve these DIMs?
No, you can't do that, right? You just
made to order.
Just in time.
Yeah. You kind of want to be like at neither of those extremes.
You're making pizza over there?
Yeah, exactly. We're making pizza. How many you want? I gotta, yeah. No, and it's like you want to like hit that balance. Like you don't want to be made to order and you don't want to hold inventory. And so the answer is like the answer kind of depends on the part, right? So you've got parts that are with thin supply chains that aren't that expensive. Like, yes, stock inventory, doesn't matter. Fortunately, the parts that like you would not want to stock as much are parts that are more commodity, right? So it's like DIMs and CPUs, you don't want to have to stock those. That's just a lot of money to stock a bunch of those. So you kind of need, and then this is where you also need partners that are going to really, and it's been, you know, it's been fun because we've had a lot of people that have believed in us from the beginning, but we've always been like, obviously we're weird. We're idiosyncratic. And all of a sudden we have these demands show up. They're like, oh my God, this is actually like you nut jobs actually might pull this thing off. And you actually do need like big numbers of, of DIMs or of disks or, you know, of boards or of chassis or what have you. So it's actually fun to go reward folks who have really believed in us for a long time. It's like, okay, now we got a big order. Let's go.
How many are you building right now? Like can you reveal versions of numbers, if not the exact number?
I'm not going to reveal our exact run rate. Let's just say that we're on this knife edge the entire time of like trying to figure out how to expand our capacity as quickly as we possibly can. We want to make sure that we're hitting the expectations for when these things are going to arrive. We don't want to have long lead times. We want to, and you know, especially during the supply chain crunch, we saw some very long lead times. I would say it's something we are spending a lot of energy on. If you go to the jobs we're hiring for, you will notice that there are several in the operations area. This is an area where we are very aggressively expanding because it's we've got a terrific operations team. Mm-hmm. Do more there.
What is the lead time? Like how do you quantify that to us? If I said, hey, I want to buy, I'm super interested.
Yeah.
I want to buy 50.
Fortunately,
general response to that.
Yeah. So I'm super interested. I want to buy 50 is like not exactly the conversation because like that number is so big that like, that's not a, there's the casual conversation.
I need four. How about I need four?
Yeah, I'll buy four. Right. And then you like, okay. So we start to get like, all right, we need to get to a PO. And then you'd be working with our operations team, be like estimating a time. If you were to buy those right now, I mean, our goal is to be at like 8 to 12 week lead times. So we would be, and in general,
not bad.
We have been, yeah, exactly. In general, we have been able to move faster than our customers mostly. That is no longer becoming the case. As the numbers get bigger and the urgency gets higher, that is not going to be the case. But it has been the case that we're ready to ship it. We need an address from you. They're like, oh, we still don't know which DC it's going to and, you know, or what have you. So it's like, we've been able to block on, we want to be at that kind of 8 to 12 week kind of lead time. We don't want to be longer than that.
I know you kind of educated us on like general compute in data centers. Jerry mentioned like Starlink. It was Star something, Jerry. What was it called? The one in Abilene, Texas.
It's just a big
Stargate.
Yeah. Huge data centers, mostly GPU based, but
yeah. I mean, is it though? Do we know what that is?
They're telling us, but I don't know. Exactly. I'm just reading the headlines.
It's like, did ChatGPT make that up? Is that a hallucination? You know,
Do you just have constant, you know, deliveries to Abilene, Texas?
Yeah, I mean, and so when you get to a certain size, that's what it looks like, right? When it gets to you start talking about, you know,
it's 10 more oxides just right there. Just look at those beautiful 10 oxides just sitting there.
Exactly.
There's 50. Exactly. Oh my gosh. There's
50 right there waiting to get installed.
Yeah. And I think it begins to look more like, okay, these things are just like streaming in effectively because you are buying them as fast as we can make them. And, you know, we got a couple of folks who are on the cusp of doing exactly that.
We've been super deep in, I suppose, money and fulfillment and operations and support. Very little on the tech though. And I'm really curious, like what are the major technical feats that you've just accomplished that's enabled this world for you? I know the integrated stack, but like, what are some major like things you're truly, truly like, I can die tomorrow because we did this and I'm happy. Yes, we accomplished the goal. What is that?
Yeah, just for the record, I don't want to die tomorrow. So just
I want to
get that out of there.
You but could.
The things.
You so understand my euphemism.
Yeah, 100%. There are a bunch of things. I mean, I what we've been able to do, it's just sad. A sad state of the industry that the bias, a construct that dates back to when I was a child, and I'm, 51 years old, being able to boot an x86 without a BIOS is like a man on the moon. And that was extraordinarily difficult. And that was one of those things, is like, you don't pull it off, you've got nothing. You don't have a product at all. Being able to, it's the approach we took to holistic boot is something that the hyperscalers haven't even done. The approach that we took to the switch, the programmable switch, and being able to integrate that in with the rack is extraordinary. And I can't believe we got it to work, and then Intel killed the part, right? We were using Intel Tofino. Intel killed the part. And so we have had to go to find another part. And we were really excited about the part we found at the X-Site Labs, called the X2, which we're really excited to go build on. And then the stuff we've been able to build on that X2 is very exciting. That's not what we're shipping today. Is really extraordinary. The things we've been able to do with the control plane, with this distributed system that was, we had done several control planes in the past and really wanted to improve on them. And actually seeing that come to fruition, being able to do an update and being able to dynamically update this thing, because we take a distributed system that we update across an air gap. And, the fact that and when we shipped our first product, it was important that we could update this thing at all. We had something that we called the update, the minimum update. That minimum update required the rack to be parked. You would stop VMs, update the software, and start the VMs again, which is like great that you could update it at all. Obviously not, like, that's not the cloud experience, right? And the ability to build a true distributed system to allow that thing to be updated truly dynamically, and to watch that unfold over, that was a long, long, long software project and required just extraordinary work from a bunch of people and so watching that come to fruition is amazing. What we've been able to go do on the service processor and getting rid of the traditional BMC, what we've been able to go do with the root of trust, having a true root of trust, being able to attest all the way up the stack, having the root of trust truly attest the SP, having the SP attest what runs on the host CPU, pulling that together into a trust quorum where you have, what we're pulling off is really extraordinary, where you get this group of sleds together and they themselves decide there are enough of us to share a secret. So in other words, if you just walk off with a sled, you don't have anything. The ability to do this with distributed storage, it's the ability to stitch all of this together and then get the power observability that we had always. There's so many things that I had always wanted, and I didn't understand why I didn't have them. And now I understand why I didn't have them, because it's really hard. It turns out a lot of this stuff is really hard. But to be able, the vision for Oxide dates back so long. It dates back, for aspects of it, over 20 years. And it's not just, it's a vision for a lot of people have had, and watching that come to fruition in so many different dimensions is extraordinarily satisfying. In terms of like the thing that like truly fills me with pride, this is going to sound corny, but it's hand on heart true. It's not the technical artifacts. I'm proud of the technical artifacts for sure. The thing that I am like tears in the eyes proud of is the team that built it. And when you walk into Oxide, there is a panel from one of the first Oxide machines signed by everybody at Oxide. And that's the first thing that you see when you walk in. And that to me is the most important thing that we've built together, is this extraordinary group of fearless, fearless technologists who are wanting to actually go kick the dent that we want to kick in the universe together. that is what is, I think that, and as I told people, it's like, this is lightning in a bottle. If Oxide were to stop tomorrow, we would all look back on this period of our careers as the apex, as this unique time period in our careers. And that is the thing that is like unequivocal that we've achieved that can't be taken away. Now, we've got a lot further we want to go. But that is the thing that I am most proud of, is that because when you convince someone, and this is why, I mean, hiring is such a, it's amazing to me how frequently this gets outsourced to people, because when you're coming to Oxide, you are giving to all of us the most precious thing. You are giving your finite time on this earth, and you're going to give that to us, and we are going to give ours to you. And that is sacred, in the words of, you know, James Carville has got this in The War Room, the documentary that follows James Carville and George Stephanopoulos. He's got this phenomenal speech at the end of the election where he talks about how sacred this is. And it is so important. And, you know, the most important kind of sale that we make is convincing someone to cast their lot with us. And God, that is so amazing. And that is the thing that I am proud, of course, of all the things that come from that, and of all of these technical artifacts and these breakthroughs that we've had, and the breakthroughs that we will have. We've got a bunch of exciting stuff in our future, but it is the crew that did it that I am hand on heart most proud of.
That's awesome. It's good to be a part of that kind of crew too, because I mean, just being able to be that kind of fearless person with a small cadre of people. You didn't have to hire thousands thus far to get there. You had to be in the sub 100s now to get to that point, which is just wild.
I would say that the fearlessness is very complimentary. There are so many things that I'm terrified about, but then someone else at Oxide will be fearless about it. I'm like, oh, thank God, hold me right now. let me weep on your shoulder. Tell me it's going to be okay.
Stronger together.
I think I wet my pants.
Well, if you're looking for a secretary, I can answer phones for $2.35.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
I'd love to be part of the crew, but I probably can just say, hello, Brian's not available right now, but leave me your name and I'll make sure he calls you back.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, should we close? Let's close down the friends and let's do you want to do a plus bonus? I got some current events I'd love to get your guys' takes.
Let's do it.
I got two things on my mind. All right.
Oh, I hope it's one of my things.
Bye, friends.
All right, bye, friends. Stay tuned, plus people, for another 20-plus Minutes of Brian. The current events that we discuss, Thomas Domke stepping down as GitHub CEO, and the downfall of Intel. Can it be saved? Brian has lots of opinions on that one. Subscribe to listen at changelog.com/plus. That's our membership program where you directly support our work, make the ads disappear, and get awesome bonuses such as extended episodes like this one. Oh, and we're also going to publish this bonus as a couple of clips on YouTube. So if you don't want to throw us any cash, but you do want to know what we think about the GitHub and Intel news, head to youtube.com/changelog. Thanks again to our partners at Fly.io and to our sponsors of this episode, CodeRabbit and Depot. Head to coderabbit.ai and depot.dev to check out their wares and tell them Changelog sent you. We'd appreciate that. Have yourself a great weekend. Share our work with a friend or three who might dig it. And let's talk again real soon.
On recipe slinging ones and zeros, and that makes you one of our heroes. Your list of to-dos is waiting for you, so why don't you go inside? No more listening to Change Lock and Friends. With Adam and Jerry, people you know. Change Lock and Friends, time to get back into the flow. Change Lock and Friends, Change Lock.